At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We are all looking for a sign, some sign, any sign that this long national economic nightmare might be turning around. It started with housing. Might it end there too? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Marketplace Whiteboard, videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. You can watch them anytime at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the 21st of August. Today, the government reported that sales of existing homes shot up in July. They jumped more than 7% from June and rose more than 5% from a year ago. Tax credits and bargains on bank-owned homes have created something of a feeding frenzy in some markets, but prices are still dropping. For some perspective, we turn to Marketplace's Steve Henn.
Jared Franz is an economist who tracks the housing market professionally and personally.
I've been looking for a house for about a year.
Last fall, when he started looking, the market locked up completely. List prices struck Franz as ridiculously inflated. But unless homeowners absolutely had to sell, they refused to negotiate.
Very stubborn. And, you know, we haggled. We didn't buy anything. And
few people did. But Lawrence Yoon, chief economist at the National Association of Realtors, says the big spike in sales this summer means the market's coming back to life.
The increase was much higher than what I anticipated. We have seen some momentum building.
A lot of that momentum's driven by buyers like Angela Ariello. She left California and moved to Las Vegas searching for a deal, and last week she found one. Three beds, three baths, and mountain views for $139,000. Her new house doesn't even have a phone line yet, so I reached her on her cell.
It just seems very smart to choose this area and to choose this type of situation.
She bought from a bank and got the $8,000 first-time homebuyer's tax credit. Franz says last month at least a third of all sales were driven by government incentives and foreclosures. But something else is happening here, too.
People are much more willing to negotiate. And prices are down.
Even homeowners who are not in financial trouble are finally coming to grips with the fact that their home may not be worth what they thought it was. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and other central bankers are in Jackson Hole, Wyoming for an annual gathering this week. Gone fishing, you might say, for positive signs in the economy. And apparently they have found them. A return to growth in the near term appears good, Bernanke said. And by the way, that sell-off last year? Good old-fashioned panic. We have Michael Bernstein on the line to parse that statement. He's Tulane University's provost and also teaches history and economics. Glad you could join us.
Thank you.
In Ben Bernanke's speech this morning, he referred to what he calls some features of a classic panic last year. Do you agree? Was it a panic?
Certainly had the potential to be a classic panic. I believe the Federal Reserve chairman meant by that the notion that, you know, there'd be a run on financial institutions with short-term lenders, you know, withdrawing their money as quickly as possible.
But this was not the conventional run on the banks that we kind of think of when we think of, for example, the Depression.
That's right. The Great Depression of the 1930s witnessed the worst sight imaginable, which is long lines at banks with locked doors. And that sort of collapse did not occur a year ago, and that has to do with a variety of reforms and regulatory mechanisms that the U.S. government has put in place since the Great Depression.
So the fact that the everyday Joe and Jane did not panic, is that what kept things from getting even worse?
Well, I think that's part of the story. It's a very good point that initially when this collapse started, I think all of us remember that, you know, for Joe and Jane consumer out there, this, you know, in a way came as sort of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was these big institutions that were teetering on the edge of oblivion. And of course, the Federal Reserve Board and other major authorities around the world started to scramble to try and maintain them. I think the fact that this initially didn't affect a broad spectrum of the population, and also given the awareness that the government is ready to step in when banks are on the verge of financial ruin, did a great deal to prevent this from cascading into a classic panic, as Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke mentioned earlier today.
So is the difference there an institution like the FDIC?
Very important, yes. Both the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, you know, stand by to make sure that depositors don't lose their money up to a certain maximum in banks that, you know, may themselves fail. So the banks may be gone in a corporate sense. They may be absorbed by other institutions or reorganized, but the money that we have on deposit there is never lost because it's insured by the federal government. That's such a huge difference from the 1930s. It just can't be emphasized enough.
What do you think it says about Chairman Bernanke's view of the current economy, and perhaps our own view, that he can actually feel comfortable enough to use the P word, to say out loud the word panic?
I think that's a great observation. I don't think that would have been possible 6 to 8 months ago,
yeah.
Certainly not a year ago. It suggests to me two things. One, indeed, the Federal Reserve Chairman sees some reasons for, if not outright optimism, certainly a sense that the worst may very well be getting behind us. But two, I think he is trying to send a message. By doing this, he is literally trying to stoke the kind of reaction that your question represents. Oh, gee, maybe things are beginning to turn around, and thereby to encourage consumers and investors to look more optimistically to the future.
Professor Bernstein, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And in fact, just like the professor said, investors jumped on the Fed chairman's comments as permission for more optimism. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. It's been a little over 2 years since the scandal in this country over lead-painted toys from China. Now China is dealing internally with two lead poisoning scandals at once, and the tally of children affected now exceeds 2,000. Both involve metal smelting facilities near rural Chinese villages. Marketplace's Scott Tong visited one of them today and sent us this report from the central province of Hunan.
Every child here has a number. Their parents identify them not so much by their names, but by the lead content in their blood, 189, 210, 349 micrograms per liter of blood. In many cases, that's double, even triple the normal level. Exactly why that is just starting to come into focus here in rural Hunan province. This villager, Ms. Wu, is the mother of two, both with suspected lead poisoning.
She says children here started getting sick in the last year. In some cases, they had fevers of 105 degrees.
They got sick and it didn't get better. They had diarrhea. Eventually, the hospital found lead poisoning, so we started to wonder about the iron smelting plant.
But the plant wasn't melting down iron, as the sign on the front gate said. It was refining manganese. And to do that takes lead, which ends up in the discharge and in the emissions.
The smoke was black and thick, darker than the clouds of a thunderstorm coming.
Villagers said at first they couldn't get anyone's attention, until they took drastic action, says parent Xiao Fengying.
We had no choice but to block the roads. The coal trucks couldn't get by, and neither could the government cars.
That's when the government agreed to test every child under 14. Now 70% of them have suspected lead poisoning. The worst cases are being treated at hospitals in the provincial capital, Changsha. 28-year-old Long Xiulan's one-year-old girl has one of the highest readings, more than 350. Doctors say the child may eventually have learning disabilities and memory loss.
This thing they call lead poisoning, it could ruin my child's life. Why did I even give birth to her? What do I have to live for?
Last week, the government closed the factory. Just outside the gate sit chunks of manganese ore piled 10 feet high. Local official Zheng Zhaoxun says the plant was set up illegally last year, and it violated several environmental emissions rules.
We have now detained two persons from the factory, and we're still hunting for the last one. We froze the refinery's bank account and took out $1,500 to help pay for children's medical costs.
Still, families here are deeply skeptical of authorities. Parent Long Xiulan says the government promised nothing to the grown-ups, who were also exposed to the lead. And she also accuses state hospitals of manipulating the data to show fewer cases of actual poisoning.
The government doesn't do much for us. They're just talking for the factory boss.
That boss is a high-ranking member of the Communist Party. And many villagers here cast this as the rich and powerful against the poor. Alex Wang of the Natural Resources Defense Council says that's often the case in China.
It's often the poorest and the most vulnerable people who end up getting hurt by pollution. You know, those people who have money and the wherewithal can move away from sources of pollution. And it's the citizens that are living close to the factories who often have no choice.
Wang thinks one bright spot in this case is the Chinese media is reporting the story quickly and openly. But inside China today, several websites carrying Western news reports about the scandal were blocked. In Hunan, central China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We have photos from one of the Chinese villages Scott visited on our website. It's marketplace.org. So what's all this about August being a quiet month? For those of you who are lucky enough to be on vacation, well, the healthcare debate exploded, banks continue to drop like flies, and the retail sector is gasping and wheezing. Oh, for a good book and a sandy beach. Instead, to review all these developments and more, we go to the weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. I'm joined by Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine. Hi, Lee.
Hi, Tess.
And Reuters financial blogger Felix Salmon. Hi, Felix.
Hi, Tess.
So we started the week with the question of whether the markets had gotten ahead of the economy when it comes to a recovery. Monday kind of went in the tank. But then for the rest of the week, investors seemed to all but ignore some bad retail reports. What do you make of this? Felix, let's start with you.
The markets haven't capitulated yet. They still seem to be in this weird delusional state that they've been in for the past few months. And so long as there isn't something absolutely gruesome out there, there's no reason why they shouldn't stay delusional for the foreseeable future. Eventually, something is going to set them off. It's going to cause some kind of a panic, and the panic's going to snowball, and you're going to start seeing a bunch of selling again.
All right. Well, let's move on from Susie Sunshine over there. Lee, you agree that investors are delusional?
I do agree, you know, especially given the week we've had with the retail results. I mean, they were really just terrible. And what gains that some retailers did see came from cost cutting and paring back and becoming more efficient, which has nothing to do with economic growth. So that said, I think what investors are looking mostly at are some signs of bottoming out in housing, in the credit markets, even manufacturing. We're seeing some good signs, but without a consumer comeback, full economic recovery isn't really possible.
Well, I also wanted to get your take on the news that General Motors rehired about 1,000 workers this week. I guess maybe cash for clunkers actually did its job. But, Lee, do you think the auto industry takes this and is able to run with it, or is this going to be a short blip?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, cash for clunkers was really an unmitigated success. But the only question is the program's ending on Monday. So they've just flipped the switch and brought back all these workers at GM.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's hard to say that demand is really going to keep up at this level. But it does bring up the question of what happens when recovery does happen. I mean, GM had all these idled workers, so it could just really flip a switch and bring them back. But most companies don't. So when recovery comes back, companies are going to be in an interesting spot.
I want to turn to healthcare, which did seem to dominate the headlines this week. President Obama is really working to gain control of the debate again. But Felix, is it working? Is it too late to take back the debate?
I think at this point it's been dragging on so long and people are so confused and there's no real good sound bites about what has to happen from the administration, that it's going to be really hard, you know, for Obama to, as you say, get a hold of the debate. And I think the best way of demonstrating that is just to have a look at what's happened to the stocks of the insurance companies, which all went through the roof.
And Lee, what do you think?
You know, I think people are in agreement, or at least used to be until this week, that we need some kind of reform, but they don't really want to look at the details and think about the details. And once they do, it just people are really resistant to change, even if they recognize that we need it. And so I think that this week and the abandonment of the public plan is a real PR hit.
You know, Felix, you mentioned that this debate has been going on for so long that people have kind of started to tune it out. But the Obama administration has only been in office for a little over 6 months.
And they've had a huge amount to do in that time. They did.
Yeah.
Inherit the middle of a major financial crisis. But the weird thing is it's not just the healthcare bill which is seeming to sputter. A lot of the momentum behind regulatory reform in the financial markets seems to be slowing down as well. I have no idea whether the legs of the regulatory reform are going to happen. And in general, everything which Obama said he was wanting to do with the matter of urgency and hasn't already happened has a big question mark over it right now.
But I would just add that all of those things are so ambitious. I mean, financial regulatory reform is massive. And, you know, I would think that things are still happening behind the scenes. But it's true. We really haven't heard much of it.
Well, frankly, I think it sounds like we all need a weekend. Agreed?
That's
for
sure.
We all need a weekend.
Felix Salmon is a financial blogger for Reuters. And Lee Gallagher is senior editor of Fortune magazine. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
Seth. Thank you.
Coming up, fighting the urge to splurge.
I was $40,000 in debt on credit cards when I got to DA, and I still had $35,000 in credit left that was free that I could use. And I kept thinking, I got another $35,000. I can keep going.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bulls chased markets to the high ground today on Wall Street. The Dow picked up 1 2/3%, 155 points, to close at 9505, the highest level this year. The Nasdaq rolled up 1.5%, 31 points, to finish at 2020. And the S&P 500 gained 1 8/10%, 18 points, to end the day at 1026. For the week, it was another good one. The Dow picked up 2%, the Nasdaq grew by 1 8/10%, and the S&P packed on 2 2/10%. All that good news on the housing front pushed home improvement retailers ahead. Home Depot built up more than 3%, and Lowe's nailed a 3.75% gain. Major European indexes were up across the board as well. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.57%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Miss anything in business news this week? Download our new podcast, After the Bell. Every Friday, Scott Jagow makes sense of the week in business and the economy. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link. Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. President Obama takes a break from the town hall meetings. He's on vacation next week. Organs for sale. The American Enterprise Institute hosts a discussion about the shortage of organ donors in the U.S. And it was a long time ago, but the impact was devastating. In the year 79, Mount Vesuvius erupted in southern Italy, burying thousands of people under layers of ash. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. And now a story about social networking. I have one particular network in mind. It's attracted a lot of venture capital money and lots of media attention, especially for something that's based on 140 characters. A growing number of its users are businesses. They're pitching products and trolling the network for clients. The question, though, is how to make money off all this. So the network is considering whether to allow businesses to pay for premium services, like detailed consumer information. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Twitter faces two big challenges. It needs to make money. Its $55 million in venture financing won't last forever. And its popularity is becoming a liability. Gary Arlen is a communications analyst. He says some people are struggling to filter out the mundane messages that dominate Twitter.
There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that people are annoyed by it or just bored by all the little tweets that show up about, you know, what I'm having for lunch or who I'm seeing for dinner tonight.
Twitter may be able to use one problem to solve the other. It's experimenting with ways to sell information about all those Twitterers to businesses, allowing marketers to cut through the clutter with targeted ads. But, says Arlen,
there's no slam dunk here that Twitter is going to succeed just because it finds a commercial roadmap.
Also in the works, what's known as geotagging. That would allow Twitter to pinpoint your geographic location for tailored ads. But high-tech analyst Rob Enderle says the strategy could backfire.
They need to generate revenue, but often what they're selling is your private information.
And privacy could be a security issue for parents or even homeowners on vacation.
This idea of sharing locations with the idea that it could be, you know, one of the top 10 things a home burglar might want as his wish list on Twitter, not to mention a predator or anybody else that might want to misuse that information.
It will be months before any of this stuff is available on Twitter. Enderle says parents will likely want to disable the geotagging feature or keep the technology out of the hands of kids. Not exactly a solution to make marketers tweet with joy. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Some debts are fun when you are acquiring them, but none are fun when you set about retiring them. A couple of lines from poet and humorist Ogden Nash that will ring true for lots of Americans these days. We are on a repayment frenzy in this country, having realized that our finances are far more fragile than we thought. For some, it's just a matter of reprioritizing savings habits. But for others, it's a matter of digging out of a deep, deep hole. And for help, more and more of those in trouble are turning to anonymous strangers.
I'm Joe. I've been a member of Debtors Anonymous for, it'll be 10 years, August 15th. I use that date because that's the date I actually stopped incurring any unsecured debt.
I met up with Joe a couple of weeks ago at the Getty Museum Cafe in West Los Angeles. High above the city, with crowds milling about, her anonymity was protected. And that's something we'll do here, too. First names only. But I can reveal what she drank.
So you have a non-fat decaf coffee here. Is that how you manage your credit life as well? Safe?
No, there's mocha.
Jo has no credit cards. Her car is paid off, and she owns her condo outright. And that certainly was not the case when she showed up for her first Debtors Anonymous meeting in mid-1999. At the time, she was making $33,000 a year.
I was $40,000 in debt on credit cards when I got to DA. And I still had $35,000 in credit left that was free that I could use. And I kept thinking, I got another $35,000. I can keep going.
Some of those cards took 6 years to pay off, but eventually she whittled it all away. Now she leads the meetings, and she says lots of debt-laden Americans are learning similar lessons in this recession.
Unfortunately, I think people have to get that low before they will decide to change. We have a saying in the program, it's not about the money. That's one of the symptoms, but it's not about the money.
In that way, Debtors Anonymous is just like its sister addiction programs for alcohol and drug abuse. DA uses a 12-step method, and members have turned the idea of debt addiction into a verb. Their problem is known as debting.
I use debting the same way people drink.
Bill is another Los Angeles area member of DA. He asked that we disguise his voice. And we met up at another anonymous location, a Metro train stop.
I just couldn't handle life in life terms. And I thought if I looked good, I would be somebody.
So Bill lived far beyond his means, racking up $50,000 in unsecured debt. He started his recovery 17 years ago and now lives debt-free, except for his mortgage. He's on the DA National Board of Directors, and he says the recession is bringing more people into what he calls the rooms, where meetings are held. He says there's no way to verify that assertion. They don't take attendance, but contributions are up. Bill also notes that the conversation has a slightly different twist these days.
All along, before we had this crunch, we'd hear a lot about most people would have credit card debt was the biggest thing. But the housing crunch and the housing market is driving what people, what newcomers I hear, into the rooms now.
I met up with one other L.A.-based DA member, Ethan. He was a mere $2,000 in debt when he joined up in 2001. But he was also trying to start and run a company, and he couldn't manage those finances while making sure he still had rent money. We chatted on a remote hiking trail high atop the Hollywood Hills.
I felt really powerless over being able to figure out how to deal with my life around money.
Now, 8 years later, he too is debt-free. I asked whether he thought it was any easier, at a time when so many people are having financial trouble, for debtors to admit they have a problem. But DAers say no.
I don't think it's easy to talk about debt or money in any time. I think that, you know, that's one of the most private, again, it comes, you know, what you make. People associate that with their self-worth. And there's so much to hide in all of that.
Ethan is now, for the first time in 2 years, again facing the question of where next month's rent will come from. Work has dried up. But at least, he says, DA's steps have taught him to hike in the hills instead of panic over money.
Now I know, as opposed to going crazy in some way, I get to come to places like this, to breathe, to step outside. This gives me perspective.
Something that's been in short supply since the nation hit the crisis button.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, we are all aware of the heated debate over illegal immigration in this country, but who knew it would extend to a foreign airline? Today, the parent company of Alaska Airlines filed its third request for the Department of Transportation to review Virgin America's citizenship status. Alaska is questioning whether Virgin is complying with foreign ownership rules. Virgin America says it is an American company, perhaps not unlike so many other citizens with British ancestry. One thing's for sure, a wall will not solve this one. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 155 points, 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ added 31 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 gained 18 points, 1 8/10%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the SEC comes under fire for not policing the securities industry.
If I went to work every day in the Department of Corrections and just left the door open and let the inmates out, that's my job, to keep them in line. Did anybody do that at the SEC? Absolutely not.
We'll hear from a couple who lost everything in the Madoff scandal. I'm Tess Vigeland. Enjoy your weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.